Collins.
Peter B. Collins News and Comment. It's Earth Day, Wednesday, April 22nd, 2020. And Earth Day is also preceded one day by yours truly's birthday. I had a nice outing solo, maintained all of my distancing requirements. I went sailing on San Francisco Bay, and the weather cooperated. We've had kind of gloomy skies, but it was almost 70 degrees, winds up to 20 knots, and it really helped restore, refresh, and, that kind of thing. I also want to acknowledge all the great greetings and funny stuff that people put up on Facebook in my honor yesterday. I really do appreciate it, and I feel invigorated and ready to go. So it is Earth Day, and I am observing it in two ways. Over at whowhatwhy.org, we've posted an interview with my longtime friend and a man I consider a personal hero. His name is Pete McCloskey, and he served in the United States Congress almost 15 years. He was one of the co-founders of Earth Day. And not only that, he's got such a colorful history. I can't cite it all for you. But as a Republican from California, he challenged Richard Nixon for president in the 1972 primary to voice his opposition to the Vietnam War. He was the first Republican elected official to call for Nixon's impeachment after the Watergate scandal was exposed. And there's much more to his story. He's helped me out with parole cases at San Quentin Prison, and I helped him out. And I'm proud to say in 2006, we conspired. Pete came out of retirement to challenge Republican Congressman Richard Pombo, and he was chairing the House Interior Committee and wanted to repeal one of the legacy bills that Pete McCloskey had co-sponsored, the Endangered Species Act. And McCloskey challenged Pombo in the primary, softened him up, and Democrat Jerry McNerney took him out in the general election in the fall. It was a great victory. Pete left the Republican Party shortly thereafter and remains a spry 92-year-old maverick. So I invite you to listen to that interview. It is centered in part around his new book, The Story of the First Earth Day. And I was only 17 at the first Earth Day. And Pete explains how it spawned a political movement, not just the environmentalist tree huggers, but a crew who had worked on Earth Day went on to defeat five members of the House and Senate in the fall of 1970. And it scared the shit out of sitting Congress members who had ignored environmentalism and the pollution and other issues that had become pretty commonplace. And so it's a great backgrounder. You can get the new book for $10 over at Amazon, The Story of the First Earth Day, 1970, under the byline of Pete McCloskey. So I encourage you to check out that interview. And also for families with children from age kindergarten to grade five, we have a special podcast for you that I posted earlier today at peterbcollins.com. And it is based on the work of a Bay Area group, which is called Cool the Earth. And Carlene Cullen is the founder of that group. She's on the interview with us. And she explains how, for young people, they have developed some animated learning tools. And these are fun little cartoons that explain the issues of climate change and the causes, human behavior. And also, there are opportunities for engagement. Families can get together and make art, create a poster, write a story or poem, make your own video. And if you submit it to Cool the Earth, that it will go toward their effort to work with the World Wildlife Federation to adopt polar bears. So it's fun, it's educational, and in addition to explaining her own odyssey into environmentalism, Carlene offers quite a few comments that I think are worth hearing. So I invite you to take a look at, or actually take a listen, to both of those podcast offerings today. And before we dive into the latest news from the land of Trump, can I share with you something that arrived from a friend on Facebook. He posts his name in Cyrillic, and I'm unable to identify him. But he shared with me the latest release from my longtime buddy Roy Zimmerman. Roy was the frontman for a group called the Four Men, who satirized Bill Clinton in the 90s. And then Roy moved into my area, went solo, and we got together quite a bit. He's appeared on this podcast numerous times. He was our entire band, musical band, at the Democratic Convention when we covered it live on my syndicated radio show back in 2008 in Denver. And he and his wife are just incredibly clever. And I think you will get a kick out of this. I'm putting up the link to the video at YouTube, and I hope this catches your ear, and you will click over to YouTube and watch the video, because it's got a lot of clever sight gags. But the audio does itself a lot of justice already.
We vote him away.
Vote him away.
Self-obsessed wing, the liar tweets tonight.
Put him away, 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 put him away.
He says, hush, you doctors, hush, reporters, hush, you science nerds. Look, my ratings are through the roof when I just say happy words.
And I have two comments. This is a masterful use of Zoom with a multi-track recording. And also, it is a dangerous earworm. That song is always stuck in my head every time I've heard, from the original to different takeoffs on it. So I apologize if you can't sleep tonight. And, the lion tweets tonight, the liar tweets tonight, is stuck in your brain and keeping you awake. So it's the perfect setup for the latest lying tweet from Donald J. Trump. Late on Monday night, he put out one of those tweets for his base, returning to his original theme of immigrant bashing. And he announced that he's shutting down America to any immigration. And of course, he reversed part of that, walked it back after people who work for him said, actually is bad for the country right now, because there are a lot of medical professionals who are here on H-1B visas and green cards, and you could really screw things up, Don. So he did, modify it. He said he would order a temporary halt in issuing green cards to prevent people from coming here, but he backed away from plans to suspend guest worker programs after business groups exploded in anger at the threat of losing access to foreign labor. And we've got a real problem in our food markets these days. Farmers are unable to pay the money to pick the crops, and they've lost huge markets in institutional, cafeterias, schools, theme parks and stadiums, all the places where they used to peddle many of their grown or products that come from meatpacking. So this is still unclear. Trump was expected to sign in one of those dramatic sessions today, and I have not yet seen details on what is actually in the latest decree from the man who wants to be our dictator. Lawyers over at the Justice Department were still studying whether Trump had the legal authority to unilaterally suspend the issuance of green cards, and the decision not to block guest workers is a major concession to the business groups who lapped up all of that money aimed at small business relief from the first round of the CARES Act. And a quote from Todd Schulte, which is a group that advocates for immigration in the tech industry. This is both a political act to demagogue and distract from his awful handling of the COVID-19 crisis and lack of testing. And it's also a policy effort by hardliners to use the crisis to enact their awful decades-old wish to radically slash immigration. And despite the source there, I think that those are accurate comments. And at the New York Times, an op-ed today co-authored by a man I deeply respect, law dean now at the University of California Berkeley Law School, Erwin Chemerinsky, along with Jennifer Chacon. And they write that the policy that Trump has declared would affect only those immigrants who've been authorized for permanent residency. The number, they say, is less than a million. I've seen elsewhere a figure of about 660,000. They say that critical industries, including the overwhelmed medical sector, will lose out on vitally needed expertise just when it's needed most. And they later say in the piece, in the Supreme Court case that allowed the original Trump immigration bans aimed at Muslims, in a dubious move by the court, the lawyers here write that Trump convinced the Supreme Court that his entry restrictions were lawful because Congress granted the president broad power in immigration law to exclude immigrants detrimental to the United States. But the portion of the law he relied on in that case should not apply to this situation, they argue. It has been used only in cases where restrictions are tied to the actions of foreign governments. That is not the case here, and the provision likely does not apply to this general ban. So we'll see. Of course, the Supreme Court has bent over backwards to enable Trump in his racist and selective immigration bans. Interesting piece that I've only seen at Common Dreams. New York State election officials are poised to remove the name of Senator Bernie Sanders from the ballot in June's primary election. Now, this is a gratuitous slam, and it appears it's one of those sneaky provisions that Governor Andrew Cuomo, who many people are just swooning over these days for his TV performance related to the pandemic's impact in New York, but the budget included a provision saying that the little-known state board of elections, dominated by two Democrats, may remove a candidate from the ballot if they make clear they are no longer seeking the office in question. And so one of those commissioners, Douglas Kellner, said, "It is not very controversial that Bernie Sanders has suspended his campaign. I anticipate we will be removing him." I want to recommend an essay today that was posted and maybe it's a couple of days old, over at the Atlantic. And George Packer is a pretty good writer. He did some interesting coverage years ago on our endless war in Afghanistan. And in a piece that is entitled, "We Are Living in a Failed State," subtitled, "The Coronavirus Didn't Break America, It Revealed What Was Already Broken." And he compares our response to a nation like Pakistan or Belarus with a shoddy infrastructure and a dysfunctional government. He says the administration squandered 2 months to prepare. The president delivered willful blindness, scapegoating, boasts, and lies. Quoting from a little later in the piece, Trump came to power as the repudiation of the Republican establishment. And like a wanton boy throwing matches in a parched field, Trump began to immolate what was left of national civic life. He never even pretended to be president of the whole country, but pitted us one against another along lines of race, sex, religion, citizenship, education, region, and every day of his presidency, political party. His main tool of governance was to lie. A third of the country locked itself in a hall of mirrors that it believed to be reality. A third drove itself mad with the effort to hold on to the idea of knowable truth. That would be, I think, you and me. And a third gave up even trying. There's much more in this piece, and you can click on the link in the show file at peterbcollins.com and take a little ride over to the Atlantic to check it out. Here's today's COVID-19 update, prepared by Linda Lewis. We have the data for you on the Jumbotron. Worldwide caseload now identified at 2.6 million, 181,000 deaths. In the United States, the cases up to 835,000, and the deaths are closing in on 46,000. The top five states remain New York, California, Texas, Florida, and New Jersey. And the situation is something we continue to cover. So there's quite a bit. One thing that I want to start with here is that in Santa Clara County, which is the seat of Silicon Valley, San Jose, we have learned from the work of coroners that a death from the virus took place in early February. Now, it was thought that the first American death was late in February on the 26th in Seattle. But the finding that a death on February 6th in Santa Clara County was a result of the virus pushes the time frame of the spread in this country weeks earlier than previously known. And they're saying they don't believe it came from a traveler from China or anywhere else. And so it is really quite mysterious. And this underscores for me parts of other issues I'll be covering today, that people who rely heavily on the available data can twist it to fit their bias. And the fact is, we don't have detailed and reliable data to evaluate, for example, whether the shelter-in-place orders, the stay-at-home orders, were an overreaction or a pretty wise precaution given the circumstances. So this Santa Clara County death occurred 3 weeks before the one in Washington State. And since the virus has an estimated incubation period of 14 days, and people who die of it are often sick for at least 3 weeks, the individual who died on February 6 could have been infected and transmitting it to others in early January. So I think this, again, shows that whether it's from China or the United States, the data are incomplete, and I, for one, am willing to wait until we get a bigger picture. And that's going to come from forensic analysis, not from heated rhetoric today. So to Linda's report of the day, the federal government has issued reopening plans, a letter dated April 20th to federal employees. They said the government is the nation's largest employer, that a plan to ramp back up government operations is based on local conditions warranting, consistent with the national guidelines that Trump issued last week and then, of course, contradicted with his support of the Liberate crowd. The guidelines include gating criteria, which must be met in a state or county before proceeding to the phased reopening process. And among the criteria, documented COVID-19 cases and prevalence of positive tests must trend downward for 14 days. But how do you get the testing? And is it broad and properly distributed enough to provide reliable projections? Those are big questions. Now, those federal workers already or still on the job in so-called essential activities like people at the post office? Well, postal workers have sounded the alarm on issues ranging from a lack of personal protective equipment to the employees facing requirements to continue working after being exposed to the virus. More than 1,200 of the Postal Service 600,000-person workforce, or about 0.2%, have tested positive so far. And OSHA, which investigates, that's a separate federal agency, has closed all of those cases, which typically means the workplace hazard has already been abated or the agency was unable to verify a violation. And I think the third option is a large rug under which these reports are swept. And since March 2nd, the OSHA state agency in Oregon received nearly 3,000 complaints related to COVID-19 safety compliance, including 100 separate employers in Deschutes County. The agency annually receives only 2,000 complaints a year. So that is quite a spike. Complaints came from employees as well as customers and passers-by, observing people working in close proximity and without protective gear. About 3 in 10 federal workers are still required to report to their normal workstations, according to a survey conducted by the Government Business Council. Only about 40% of federal workers still go to their normal workstations. The rest are working at home. And one employee at the U.S. Citizenship and Immigration Services said the major impact has been on operations. We had to cancel thousands of interviews for permanent residency and naturalization and many ceremonies to make people U.S. citizens. And the publication Government Executive spoke to employees at more than half a dozen facilities, and they complained of inconsistent guidance and unsafe working conditions. Most significantly, at the Veterans Administration, they've instituted policies under which employees who worked with COVID-19 positive patients before their status was known should continue to work until they develop symptoms, after which they could then be tested for the virus. In some cases, these included nurses and doctors who later tested positive for the virus but returned after 7 days when their symptoms were no longer evident. So those who take time off to self-isolate after a potential exposure without experiencing symptoms risk being labeled absent without leave. In another big hit on the pork processing industry, Tyson Foods suspended operations today at a plant in Iowa. They said that the indefinite closure of the Waterloo pork plant would deny a vital market to hog farmers and further disrupt the nation's meat supply. So it's time to stop hoarding toilet paper, and if you're a bacon person, you better stock up. Linda also reports today that the number of infections may be vastly undercounted. Survey results from Germany, Netherlands, and several other locations here in the United States find that anywhere from 2% to 30% of certain populations have already been infected. And, of course, some of the contrarians use this to say, look, the number of deaths related to the number of infections is really, really low. But I think we have to look at not just infections, because we know that many people, it passes through them without symptoms ever developing. And I don't think that is a reliable baseline to compare the death rate to. Medical officials here in California, as we mentioned, have discovered that the earliest deaths occurred here February 6th and February 17th. Testing capacity remains seriously inadequate. 2 months into the pandemic, the number of COVID-19 molecular diagnostic tests across the U.S. Stands at about 4 million as of Monday, about 150,000 per day in the last couple of weeks. Experts say it's not nearly enough to track new infections adequately, and of course, it is a major metric of the Trump plan of when you can so-called reopen businesses and reduce restrictions on the public. And the other impact worldwide is that famines and sharp food shortages in about 36 countries are likely to occur, and also the current collapse of the oil markets worldwide are another factor that we'll cite a little bit later in today's podcast. Also, I do want to make a correction. In Monday's report from Linda Lewis, I took two items and I kind of mangled them into one. And so I want to try to separate it for you. The first story was about a company called Trinity, and it was a discussion of whether Trinity was a small enough business entity to qualify for the small business loans. And then, in a separate item, Linda had covered the issue of Grainger, which is a company that has been buying PPE and reselling it, often for double the cost. So I did kind of combine Trinity and Grainger incorrectly, and I apologize for that error. Now, as you know, prisons are a hotbed of transmission of the coronavirus. And some of the biggest outbreaks are at the Cook County Jail, at a federal prison in Marion, Ohio. Maybe that's a state prison. I don't want to be wrong about that. But these are very serious transmission zones. And a new study coming from the ACLU projects that as many as 100,000 American prisoners could die from the coronavirus. And that is a scary factor, even if it's off the mark. Even numbers one-tenth of that would be quite alarming to me. And over at The Intercept, a good enterprise journalism piece. Prison officials in at least three states are using software to scan inmate phone calls for mentions of the coronavirus. Now, one of the positive moves under the CARES Act was that the policies were changed at the federal level to provide for free phone calls. But phone calls in and out of prisons have always been recorded and monitored. You simply can't say anything you don't want a prison official to know about. Well, now there's new monitoring software, which was created by a company called Leo Technologies. And one of the lead investors there is a guy named Elliot Broidy. He's a guy who was tight with Michael Cohen, raised a lot of money for Trump, and has profited handily from it. So this software was intended to garner information on whether an inmate was planning a suicide or an escape or things of that nature. And now they are deploying it to record key words where a prisoner says to a loved one, oh, you know, I've got a fever, I've been sneezing and coughing a lot. And this is just such malignant intent coupled with surveillance. Because the prison officials, instead of listening in on phone calls, should be reducing the population, isolating prisoners as much as humanly possible inside these crowded institutions, and testing them instead of listening in on their phone calls. It's just ridiculous. So just before I sat down, and I am recording late today, I took a day off and that was nice, but the catch-up has been a little brutal for me. Dr. Rick Bright, who was the director of the Biomedical Advanced Research and Development Authority at the Department of Health and Human Services, says that he was abruptly dismissed this week because he reported that the use of these chloroquine drugs have not been successful. Now, there is a report out today from the National Institutes of Health, and it backs up what Anthony Fauci has been saying, that hydrochloroquine and its use in a combination with AZT, it's unproven. And there are these preliminary studies that can't be totally relied upon. They're clinical trials, but they're not studies with a control group. And over at the Veterans Administration, they've seen people who were placed on these drugs die at a higher and faster rate than people who did not use them. And again, this is a rush job in an effort to desperately find something that will work, but they don't match the standards for investigations of these drugs. And we have to be careful when there's a snake oil con man behind a podium in the White House saying, oh, just try it. What do you got to lose? So over at the Washington Post today, two epidemiologists, Sandra McCoy and Pia McDonald, argue something that fits my bias. And that is that the death toll so far doesn't mean that we're overreacting. It means that shutdowns are helping. And there are many people who want to seize on the preliminary data, as I've been arguing here today, and use it to feed their own bias. And I admit that I could be wrong about this. But it appears to me that the stay-at-home orders that have led to a dramatic shutdown in the economy, loss of incomes to millions of Americans, a true hardship, are really the only option that was available. We've just covered that there are no treatments available. Vaccines are controversial, but if there's one available, it's going to be in 18 months or longer. And so with a virus that was so highly contagious and a new one that in many ways baffles us still, I actually believe that this was the wisest thing to do. And they write, "The paradox of public health is that when it works, nothing happens. Most people agree to be vaccinated without knowing if they'll ever be exposed to an infectious disease like measles. Similarly, we may never know for sure how bad the COVID-19 pandemic would have been without aggressive control measures." And later they write, "We don't know yet whether a middle ground approach like the one taken by Sweden will prove effective. There, most schools and restaurants remain open, and while the elderly have been told to self-isolate, the country is not under lockdown. But Sweden's death rate is now one of the highest in Europe, at 175 deaths per million, higher than the current death rate in the United States of 136 per million, Denmark, 64 per million, Norway, 28 per million. And again, these data are preliminary and wobbly. They are snapshots. And as I'll get to toward the end of the podcast, I am not so certain as some of my contrarian friends are about how to interpret the data. So as you may know, I've set up the Peter B. Collins Podcast Community Fund to help listeners who are really hurting at this difficult time. And we have been raising money. I want to identify two recent contributors, New York photographer Alex Crokey. And Alex, I thank you for your idea about contributing photographs, and I'll be in touch with you soon to see if there's a way that we can make that workable. Also, Lamara Williams-Jones made a recent contribution over at PayPal, and I greatly appreciate those contributions. Now, I need you to come forward if you are in need at this time. I don't have any requests over the last few days for $100 grants, so get on the stick, email me right now, peter@peterbcollins.com, and we can give you a little relief in the form of 100 American dollars. And you don't have to be residing in the United States to qualify. All you have to do is communicate with me at peter@peterbcollins.com. If you want to contribute at PayPal, you can go to peterbcollins.com/signup, and there is a link there to make a contribution at PayPal of any amount, linked to my email, again, peter@peterbcollins.com. And you can also mail it to my post office box, number 150660, San Rafael, California, 94915. So the bill that was improved by Democrats, who Republicans said were obstructing, has passed the Senate. It's worth just under $500 billion. And I argue that it's woefully short and it doesn't all go to the right places. But approval in the House, which is scheduled for a vote tomorrow, and that vote will only be comprised of members who can get themselves to Washington, many of whom are not willing to fly right now. So it's going to be dominated by people within, say, a 6 or 7 hour drive of Washington, D.C. And it is unclear whether the bill will pass. There are Republicans who say that it's too much. And here's Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez of New York. "It is insulting to think that we can pass such a small amount of money in the context of not knowing when Congress is even going to reconvene. Pass such a small amount of money, pat ourselves on the back, and leave town again. I need legislation that is going to save people's lives." And we also have the ugly scam of how they've dumped another $300-plus billion into small business relief, and the lion's share of that went to California. I'm not saying there aren't businesses here that don't need it, but it primarily went to bigger corporations and not the taqueria and the mom-and-pop grocery store or the nonprofit, all of whom have been hammered and are now teetering on the brink of going out of business because of the interruption. And I'm sorry to say, I don't expect that to be fixed soon. And I know a number of people, representing their business or nonprofit who are applying for these funds. And if they get anything, I'll bet it'll be 10% of what they ask for. And you know how Elizabeth Warren, before she ran for the Senate, was tapped by Obama to set up the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, and it was doing a good job of reining in extreme practices by banks and other lenders? Well, a Trump appointee named Kathy Craninger is now running the shop over there, and I think they need to change the name to Consumer Financial Exploitation Bureau, because she is moving forward with relief for one of the most beleaguered industries in America, the payday loan sector. And this is a time when we need to control their bad behavior more than ever. We started out with Earth Day, and Bill McKibben, one of the leaders of 350.org and a prolific author on the subject, he wrote an op-ed that appears at The Guardian. We've linked to it. You can find it at my show file at peterbcollins.com. And he gives a little history about Earth Day, leaves out Pete McCloskey, but that's okay. And so he says, you have to take on the heart of global capital, and so we are. He has a coalition of environmental and climate justice groups called Stop the Money Pipeline. And they are petitioning and protesting banks like JP Morgan Chase to stop funneling money into the fossil fuel industry. They have pumped in $250 billion, he says, since the Paris Agreement was signed in 2015. Insurers like Liberty Mutual, you can sing their song, still insuring tar sands projects, even as pipeline builders endanger native communities trying to build the Keystone XL pipeline. In January, BlackRock announced it was going to put climate at the heart of its investment analyses. And so he feels they're making some progress. He says the pandemic may be causing as much trouble for the fossil fuel industry as our campaign hoped to. With the demand for oil cratering, it's clear that these companies have no future. The divestment campaign that over a decade has enlisted $14 trillion in endowments and portfolios in the climate fight has a new head of steam. And I want to present the counterweight to that. I would love to see the oil industry and the coal industry just tapered off and shut down. And there will be a measurable and dangerous economic impact on jobs and workers here in the United States. But already, the impact of the collapse of oil, and it hit that negative benchmark the other day where they're now paying people to take crude off their hands. Trump is considering a blockade of oil imports. He has tweeted at the Saudis and his good friend Mohammed bin Salman to turn around 19 supertankers loaded with crude bound for the United States. But that's protectionism. And in an article that I've linked to in today's New York Times, they show how the oil shock is impacting countries around the world, including Iraq, Mexico, Venezuela and Ecuador, Nigeria, even the Saudis and Russia. And while you may not have sympathies for some of those countries, and their leaders in particular, real people will be hurt by this. So I want to turn now to some recent reports that, as you will hear, have generated some controversy, some from people that I know and respect. So let me start with Caitlin Johnstone's piece published today, actually yesterday, at consortiumnews.com. And she says, hysteria about China has been kicked into high gear by the political media class who are responsible for manufacturing support for the Cold War escalations, which will be necessary to prevent the U.S. from being surpassed on the world stage as a unipolar superpower. And she quotes the shrill Jeanine Pirro over on the Fox channel. Later, she writes, the claim that rival parties have been infiltrated by communists has a very long and ugly history in U.S. politics. And it's been claimed by some of these crazy people on Fox that Democrats are aligned with China, and that China, you know, Trump vilifies them as a way to divert attention. And my mind is not yet made up on how much culpability China has in the outbreak that became a pandemic. And neither can I exonerate the United States as the source of this virus. It's just too soon to tell, and I'm not ready to just lean on the attack China line because it's an easy saw. So that's where she writes that it's now being weaponized by the American right in such a shameless way that we can expect it to get a whole lot uglier. Then she writes, not to be outdone, the Democrats are now working to out-Trump Trump, with House Speaker Nancy Pelosi demanding that Trump swiftly begin implementing the Hong Kong Human Rights and Democracy Act, and a new Biden campaign ad attacking the president for being too soft on China. And, of course, Trump has an ad out there from one of his super PACs that demonizes Joe Biden for being too nice to China. But the fact is that Trump did praise China 15 times in January and February, and we know that he has bungled the American response. So she makes some interesting points. And then we go to a piece by Joe Lauria, the editor-in-chief at Consortium News, who slams the New York Times for what he compares to Russiagate and its promotion of the hysteria against Russia based on unnamed sources and evidence that was never publicly available. And he writes, just as the Democratic Party attempted to shift the blame from its disastrous 2016 loss onto Russia, the Trump administration is now trying to shift the blame from Trump's disastrous handling of the coronavirus crisis onto China. And he says, once again, the New York Times is the vehicle. And he reports on a front page story that I saw today at the Times, reporting as flat fact, that Chinese agents helped spread messages to millions of Americans about a fake lockdown last month, sowing virus panic in the U.S. One of the messages said Trump would lock down the entire nation. They will announce this as soon as they have troops in place to help prevent rioters and looters. Later, he writes, the Times story shamelessly revives and links China's alleged misdeeds to Russiagate. Quote, American officials said China, borrowing from Russia's strategies, has been trying to widen political divisions in the United States. As public dissent simmers over lockdown policies in several states, officials worry it will be easy for China and Russia to amplify the partisan disagreements. And he closes, Lauria does, now is the time for nations to cooperate, and that includes the U.S. and China, in defeating this historic pandemic. There will be time later to investigate how the virus originated, how governments responded to it. The early view is that hardly any government responded with the urgency required. Now we turn to Pepe Escobar. And by the way, I have almost complete confirmation that Pepe will make himself available for a PBC interview on Friday this week. He conditioned it on breaking news, and we always respect that with a working journalist like Pepe Escobar. But he writes that... The article headlines with this question, what did U.S. intel really know about the Chinese virus? And he starts off with a series of lawsuits, some from a group in Florida linked to the Democrats and another linked to Republicans. And they're demanding that China should shell out tons of cash to the tune of at least $1.2 trillion, which amounts to the total of U.S. Treasury bills held by Beijing. And a lawsuit in Texas is demanding $20 trillion in damages. And so Pepe retraces some of the coverage of the alleged intelligence reports that Scott Ritter and I talked about over a month ago that originated in November of last year. Then Pepe sets up a little timeline here. On November 12th, a married couple from Inner Mongolia was admitted to a Beijing hospital seeking treatment for pneumonic plague. On the Chinese equivalent of Twitter, Weibo, their CDC told public opinion that the chances of this being a new plague were extremely low. 4 days later, a third case of this plague was identified, a man also from Inner Mongolia with no connection to the couple. Then, the CDC in China repeated, there's no need to worry about the risk of infection. Of course, there was plenty of skepticism. Then he says, the key point is that the three Inner Mongolian cases seem to have been caused by a detectable bacteria, and COVID-19 is a virus, not a bacteria. So, he writes, it's out of the question that American intelligence, in this case the NCMI, that's the little-known intelligence unit about health issues that Scott Ritter told us about, that they were unaware of these developments. So if the NCMI product is not a fake and really exists, it only found evidence of some vague instances of pneumonic plague. And the point he's making here is that the U.S. may have had knowledge of this pending pandemic before the Chinese even discovered their first real case. This pushes the timeline for Chinese discovery back to January 3rd in Pepe's timeline, and that makes a big difference. He says then, validating the ABC News report, Israel steps in. Israeli intel confirms American intel did in fact warn them in November about a potentially catastrophic pandemic. The bottom line, the Trump administration had an advance warning of no less than 4 months from November to March, and they did nothing. The whole China is a witch case is debunked, he writes. It's never enough to repeat the question in full. How could U.S. intel have known about a contagion a month before Chinese doctors detected an unknown virus? So now I want to turn to some recent commentary that many of my listeners get. It's from the News from Underground service that's managed by New York University Professor of Media, Mark Crispin Miller. And Mark is a man I've been in touch with now for over 15 years. I value the service that he provides, bringing us reports that are often contrary to the mainstream media in this country. But I believe that Mark is off on a kind of detour. And here's one of his recent posts from yesterday. He cites a video, which I looked at, of the crowd of people who want to be dismissed from home confinement in Sacramento, California last week. And he brings us the speech of a human rights attorney named Lee Dundas, a woman. And he says that she speaks some truth because she wants the lockdown to end. But also, the pictures show the crowd is clearly not a throng of brown shirts. It seems remarkably diverse, he said, with hippie types and fervent Christians, among others, standing shoulder to shoulder. In short, he says, this video is evidence that those out there protesting house arrest are not just feral rightists, as our quote-unquote free press asserts across the board. Having watched this and her audience, check out the social justice talking heads on MSNBC, contending or imagining that such protesters are mainly driven by a wish that more and more black and brown people will die. Such paranoid divisiveness will kill us all if we don't overcome. Now, I think that Miller's conclusion there is as unsupportable as the claim that he makes about the MSNBC panel. Because I believe that the people who say, let's reopen the country, let's go back to work, who cares who dies, they know that the fatality rate for COVID-19 in the United States has disproportionately taken the lives of African Americans. And so to know that, as the governor of Georgia, Brian Kemp, does, and move to reopen beauty parlors, as if that's the most essential thing that people are missing right now. And he does it arguing that, these are small businesses whose livelihoods depend on it, and they may not survive. Well, I think it's up to him to bail them out, not to reopen them, at a time when Georgia has not had the 14-day period of reduction of identified cases, hospitalizations, and fatalities. So I didn't watch the MSNBC show. I don't defend what that network does. But I think that pointing out those two factors is not unfair. So then Miller, in a separate email, in a lengthy piece, goes out after Consortium News and Joe Lauria, because Lauria published a set of comments that were attributed to Guterres, who is the UN Secretary General. And he called out conspiracy theories in social media. And I think that it was a news report, maybe just from a press release, but I don't believe it was an editorial from Consortium News. But that's how Mark Crispin Miller took it. He said, "Consortium News has just gone over to the enemy by publishing a solemn editorial highlighting Secretary General Antonio Guterres' recent diatribe against the dangerous epidemic of misinformation about COVID-19. Quote, wild conspiracy theories are infecting the internet, raved the UN chief, casting all such dissident material as itself a plague that clearly must be cured, which is to say wiped out, just like that apocalyptic virus." Now, I think that it's fair to report the Secretary General's comments. I don't traffic in conspiracy theories. My job, I view, is to uncover cover-ups, which often expose conspiracy theories. But in this piece, I feel that Miller is, grinding an axe. And while I do support his right to publish and disseminate information that is contrary to what, Anthony Fauci, who he's dubbed Ill Fauci, says, I don't happen to agree with him. And particularly, as you've heard, as I rail against these mini mobs that have been amplified by media coverage, not limited to the Fox News channel. And by the way, I've linked to an article by Steve Horn, the reporter who I respect, and he published this at DSmogBlog. I've linked to it. But he shows how many of these conservative groups and individuals are linked to the climate denial movement, well-funded, and they've had some success, I think, in rolling back public opinion related to concern about human-caused climate change. So I encourage you to read what I think is an offset to Miller's arguments from the reporting of Steve Horn. And then we turn to a heartfelt letter from Dick Attlee. He corresponds with me occasionally. I have a lot of respect for his both his knowledge and his rhetorical method. And in a lengthy email that he wrote to me, last night, he said he was listening to my Monday podcast. "It's the first time ever that I found myself exceedingly uncomfortable with what you were saying." And he wasn't sure where to begin, he said. He said, "You seem to hate Trump so much, and there's nothing wrong with that, that you seem blinded to the fact that you're now relying on the New York Times and the Washington Post for almost all your information, after having decried them incessantly over their support for Hillary and then for Russiagate. Of course, they're going to spend most of their time framing everything in terms of anti-Trump." He says, at the root is your apparent belief that Tony Fauci is on the right path, that there is no hidden agenda in his urge to lock everyone down and get them to stay there until there is a vaccine, a world in which he is thoroughly financially and ideologically entangled. I'm sorry you apparently haven't had access to the large and growing body of science that says this approach is flat out wrong." Well, let me say a few things here. First of all, as you hear at the beginning of every podcast, my focus is on news and opinion. My beat is politics. And also, I try to instill in my listeners critical review of the media. And in the very podcast dated April 20th, that Dick Attlee is referring to, I attacked the corporate media, including the New York Times in particular, for the exaggeration of this liberate movement. which is a few extremists who know how to create images that are picked up for B-roll. And I explained how CNN had B-roll from a chopper in Huntington Beach, California last Saturday, the loop they played over and over again of a very small group of people. And let me concede that I am not deeply steeped in science, in epidemiology, and as I have shared with you throughout this podcast, I am skeptical of the use of data to deliver conclusions at this very early stage of what I think is going to be a lengthy pandemic. And so, Dick, I respect your point of view, and I respect that you study a broader range of sources. But one of the reasons I use the Post and the Times is that they really set the tone for corporate media in this country. They are the reference point from which I launch my critiques. And yes, I do find occasional good reporting and commentary in both of those outlets, and I'm not afraid to say so. But I think it's unfair to consider me somehow blinded or unwilling to address contrarian views. In the same podcast on Monday that Dick Attlee is critical of, I spent 3 or 4 minutes citing Robert F. Kennedy's critique of the statistics related to flu in general that are relied upon to compare the coronavirus to the annual death rate from what's considered to be a common flu. And later he writes, there are plenty of papers coming out on the fact that none of the antibody test kits has ever been tested for accuracy, and that at this point we have no way of knowing how many people are infected or have been infected. Now, I made that point today, and I've made that point many times previously. And that's why I am trying to cover. I don't pretend to be fair or balanced. This podcast is my view of the news of the day. And sometimes that news doesn't include the broad range that Dick Attlee would like to see. Let me cite a couple of more comments. I honestly think you're making a big mistake by trying to interpret everything here in terms of Trump, a trap which I thought you had avoided in the years of Russiagate. I listened to an interview with one of the women in the Michigan demonstration. She was very upset by the guys with guns on the Capitol steps, that was not what the demonstration was about. Now, I'm sorry. The origins of these mini-mob so-called protests are very clear. And the fact that other people are drawn to it, maybe just happened to be in the neighborhood, or maybe they showed up intentionally because, for example, in Michigan, the ban on people traveling to their vacation homes or using their boats, I think, is a little extreme too. But right now is not the season for boating in Michigan. And while, you know, being blocked from going away for the weekend to your home on the lake or your home in the woods, which is very common for middle-class people in Michigan, I understand that people chafe at that. But to participate in a rally driven by gun rights activists who think that the NRA is too tame? I'm sorry. So we'll let Dick have the last word. Please be careful, Peter. When you start listening to the NYT and the WAPO, you're putting yourself at serious risk. Thank you, Dick. I appreciate the interaction, the commentary, and I'm always open to criticism. Thanks for listening to my daily news and comment podcast. You're free to share it everywhere. You'll find it on YouTube. I remain Peter B. Collins.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails.